There's a lot to love about aluminum, as far as metals go.
It is lightweight, it's durable, it's corrosion resistant, formable.
But what's its carbon footprint? I'm Carol Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the new market for greener aluminum. Plus, a sociologist tries to understand why red state voters seem to be so against environmental regulation.
He had suffered terribly, and what took his community away was not the presence of government, it was the absence of government.
And a certain purple flower transforms a walk in the wilds of West Virginia.
It's a treasure hunt, there's no doubt, it's treasure.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We've seen the photos of Superfund sites in Houston, surrounded by water from Hurricane Harvey, and more dangerous than ever to the people living nearby. Well, Pennsylvania could lose millions of dollars in federal funds to clean up its hazardous waste. That's if President Trump's budget cuts for the Environmental Protection Agency get through Congress. According to a report released by the Environmental Defense Fund, a 30% cut in EPA funding for Superfund cleanups could impact 95 sites across the state. L.G. Holstein is a senior director at the Environmental Defense Fund.
Anyone who tells you that partial funding, a little tightening of the belt here and there won't do any harm, truly doesn't understand how these grants work.
Funds to clean up old industrial sites called brownfields could also be cut by a third.
Both Superfund sites and brownfield sites have similar effects on communities. The longer they sit untended, often the more danger they pose.
According to the report, Pennsylvania received more than $51 million in EPA grants to clean up brownfields and Superfund sites over the last 5 years. Go to our website for the full report on how cuts to EPA programs will impact Pennsylvania. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. What do Trump supporters want when it comes to the environment? Arlie Hochschild is a UC Berkeley sociologist who wanted to know. So she spent 5 years interviewing dozens of Tea Party members and Trump supporters in Louisiana. It became a best-selling book, Strangers in Their Own Land. For our Trump on Earth podcast, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Hochschild.
What was the central question that you wanted to answer in your research?
I started with what I thought of as a red state paradox. It's this: why would it be that across the nation, it's the poorest states, the states with the most pollution and the lowest life expectancies, are also those states that receive more money from the federal government in aid than they give to it in tax dollars, and are generally opposed to the federal government's activities? Louisiana turned out to be an exaggerated version of the red state paradox. So my question was, what experiences lead to the feelings behind this position?
You know, Louisiana is sort of home to some of these horrible environmental disasters, like the BP oil spill. There's the Bayou Corn sinkhole, which is this crazy industrial accident involving a salt dome thousands of feet below a bayou. But, you know, the folks there sort of struggle to sort of place blame on corporate malfeasance.
They don't place it on corporate malfeasance. That's what I was opening my ears to. I interviewed a man who, after Bayou Corn had been officially evacuated, was still living there. He couldn't bring himself to leave. And his interview with me began with his saying, you know, the problem with federal government is it takes community away. And, you know, we ought to have neighborly feeling and do for each other. And big government comes and offers services that replace neighborly help. And yet, in the course of his life, what happened to him was that it was an underregulated industry, Texas brine, which drilled a hole into the bottom of a bayou. First, there were earthquakes where there had never been earthquakes before. very alarmed by that. And then he began to notice methane gas. When it was raining, it was like Alka-Seltzer tablets in the puddles. But he had a gas monitor in his garage. That's how much he didn't want to leave his home. And he had suffered terribly. And what took his community away was not the presence of government, it was the absence of government or a countervailing force to regulate industry. And he was big Tea Party and big Trump supporter. In his case, partly the federal government represented the powerful North that was always wagging its moral finger at the South and blaming the sin of slavery on the present inhabitants of the South, the carpetbaggers and even environmentalists he saw as kind of coming with in a scolding spirit. But the federal government, in his mind, was also an instrument of inept officials. And he took that idea from his experience with the Louisiana state government. And he had a real point on that, because it was not, in fact, really regulating polluters. It said it was, but it wasn't. And out fishing one day, I put it to him, "Hey, Mike, it looks to me this way. Let me know if you agree that the industries, in a way, controls the state of Louisiana. It is an oil state. And the politicians in Baton Rouge owe their elections to donations from the large oil and petrochemical plants. And since they, in essence, control it, they outsource the moral dirty work to the state. So the state is in the position of promising to protect the people and regulate the polluters and not actually doing it." So people, they say, "Wait a minute, why is my tax dollar going to pay people that aren't protecting me?" So Sky Mike said, "Well, I don't think government can help me."
He said he didn't think that government was the solution?
No. When I pointed out that the state of California had lower rate of pollution, had higher regulations, and now a third of its energy comes from renewable sources, which don't pollute the earth, and is moving toward a goal of being reliant for 50% of its energy by 2030 on renewables. And he said, "Well, you know, we're running out of oil anyway. I'd be for solar or wind. These are good ideas." So there was actual common ground that one could reach.
There's a lot more of Reed Frazier's conversation with Arlie Hochschild, the author of Strangers in Their Own Land, on our Trump on Earth podcast. Listen at trumponearth.org. It's a co-production with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. That's trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Alcoa is officially moving its headquarters back to Pittsburgh, and it's at a time when worldwide sales of aluminum are on the rise. This is happening, at least in some part, because there can be environmental benefits to using aluminum in products. But there's a dirtier side to it. Aluminum production is energy intensive. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant looks at the emerging demand for a greener aluminum.
In 2015, Ford kicked off a battle in the U.S. auto industry. The body of its iconic F-150 truck was no longer made of steel.
"This is the Ford F-150, the only pickup with a high-strength, military-grade aluminum alloy body. Of all the full-size, half-ton pickups, it's got the highest gas mileage."
Ford pushed the benefits. Aluminum's lighter weight shaved 700 pounds off the F-150, improving its fuel efficiency and reducing tailpipe emissions. Then the competition, Chevy, fired back. Here's industry video blogger Ken Pilcher talking about it in 2015.
"Instead of advertising Chevy's new features, they've been knocking Ford and aluminum by calling it weak and unfit for trucks.
But then?
Chevy has just been caught with their pants down. That's right, someone had better tell the marketing team to stop running those ads, because Chevy's going to be using aluminum now too."
Industry analysts expect more U.S. automakers to significantly increase their use of aluminum in the coming years. One reason, despite President Trump's decision to halt new fuel efficiency standards, California and 12 other states are moving forward with tougher regulations, as are Europe and other countries around the world. Christine Keener says aluminum will help these efforts. She's vice president of commercial sales at Alcoa.
It is lightweight, it's durable, it's corrosion resistant, formable. And because of all of those wonderful properties, it's used in planes, cars, trucks, buses, trains, buildings, making all of them more energy efficient, as well as helping to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as a result.
This means the finished products, the trucks, buildings, and iPhones, are friendlier for the climate. Under the Paris Climate Agreement, nearly 200 countries are pushing to reduce their carbon footprints. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of that accord. But automakers, the electronics and packaging industries still face pressure from regulators, investors, and consumers around the world that want them to reduce carbon down their entire supply chain. And that's one area where aluminum is on shakier environmental ground. Producing it uses a lot of energy and emits a lot of greenhouse gases. Compare it with steel. For each ton of steel produced, 2 tons of carbon is emitted. For each ton of aluminum, the worldwide average is 11.7 tons of carbon, nearly 6 times as much. But Keener says not all aluminum is equal.
If you look at Alcoa's total purchased electricity, 71% came from renewable sources in 2016.
The amount of coal-powered aluminum produced has more than doubled since 2005, largely because of China's expansion into the market. Alcoa, along with Rio Tinto, an aluminum maker based in London, both with significant renewable hydroelectricity capacity, see this as a market opportunity. Alcoa introduced a new sustainable line last year. It includes a premium-priced product, which guarantees that each ton of aluminum produced creates no more than 2.5 tons of carbon emissions,
which is an emissions ratio that is about 75% better than the industry average.
While demand is still relatively low, it's growing. There's an effort called the Aluminum Stewardship Initiative. It's a group of producers and manufacturers, including Alcoa and Apple, working to create an industry-wide certification for sustainable production. Fiona Solomon is the chief executive based in Australia. Like many certifications, she says this is starting as a way for a small percentage of producers to differentiate themselves.
But ultimately, standards programs want to kind of say, you know, we're trying to raise all boats here. You know, we're not just creating a label so that someone over there gets a premium and good for you. You know, we actually want to see that adopted broadly, you know, for it to become a mainstream expectation.
We spoke via Skype. Solomon says they expect to start certifying aluminum production by the end of this year. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Do you have a hobby? Can't wait to get some time away from work or your family just to do that one thing? Then you might understand just a little bit how these guys feel about orchids.
Some people play golf. We did North American orchids, so we were just orchid crazy.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we go on the hunt for wild orchids in West Virginia.
Here's a Lassera.
I'll be darned. Where? I don't see it.
Oh, there it is.
Stay tuned. We just heard about aluminum's carbon footprint, but making the metal has a lot of other environmental impacts. Take a small, isolated country in South America.
If you're saying it in Dutch, it's Suriname, but it's Suriname in America.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Rich Lord and some colleagues traveled to Suriname in March to learn about the history of Alcoa's aluminum business there. I talked with him recently about the series of stories, photographs, and videos they produced called The Land Alcoa Dammed. I think Suriname is not a place that a lot of people are familiar with. So why was Alcoa there?
Alcoa went to Suriname in 1916, which was not too long after a traveling Frenchman discovered bauxite in the jungles of Suriname. And bauxite is the raw material from which aluminum derives. A number of companies went to check it out, and Alcoa was the one that did the most thorough job. And from 1916 until 2016, Alcoa was a presence in the country. It eventually obtained mining concessions. built an entirely integrated aluminum industry in this little country of Suriname on the northern coast of South America. They mined the bauxite there. They refined it into what's called alumina, and then they smelted it into aluminum all within this little country.
And now Alcoa is leaving Suriname, and they're leaving a controversy. What's at issue?
Alcoa announced in December of 2015 that it was pretty much finished in Suriname. The supplies of bauxite for which it had concessions were running out. It found that its operations there were among its least efficient operations in the world. And so they announced they were shutting everything down and pulling out. Of course, Alcoa has a lot of property there. It has areas that were mined out and haven't yet been reforested. It has a refinery, giant lakes of red muck that came out of the aluminum process. And most of all, it has a huge dam in Suriname. The dam became the focal point of the public debate over what happens when Alcoa leaves. The dam is owned by Alcoa's subsidiary in Suriname called Suralco. So the dam is really owned by Alcoa, but it was built in the 1960s under the condition that Alcoa could own and operate the dam as long as it had an aluminum business in Suriname. When Alcoa shuts down its aluminum business, the Surinamese government says, hey, wait a minute, guys, if you don't have an aluminum industry, we want the dam. And behind the dam, there's 618 square miles of lake that had formed after the Suriname River was dammed. So one of the biggest controversies in this little country right now is what happens to that dam and what does Alcoa have to do to clean up all of these various impacts that it made on the country over 100 years.
Your series is called The Land Alcoa Dammed, meaning that physical hydroelectric dam that Alcoa built there to fuel their operations. But is there kind of a double meaning there because of how the environment changed as a result of Alcoa's actions?
Well, Alcoa undoubtedly had a lot of impacts on the country, positive and negative. And certainly Alcoa makes a compelling case that the positive impacts outweighed the negative. You had a unionized workforce of 5,000 people. A middle class was created out of this industry. You had an education system that was largely a byproduct of the need to educate people to be in the aluminum industry. You had a lot of people from this country that were able to go to college because of this industry. But you also have these very large ongoing impacts. When that dam was built and an area of about 618 square miles was flooded, they had to move 6,000 people who lived on that land. An area, you know, not that much smaller than all of Allegheny County, which had been pristine forest, that's a gigantic environmental impact right there, and one that they're still wrestling with the ramifications of now. Of course, you also have these red mud lakes of essentially refinery tailings, as they're called, chemicals and substances that come out when you turn the bauxite into alumina. So you have areas that were forest, which are now essentially red, stony, barren fields that need to be reforested. Sometimes they encircle more or less villages there in which people have traditionally relied on the forest. So while we spelled it D-A-M-M-E-D, the Land Alcoa Dammed because of the dam, some within Suriname feel that they're still dealing with what we call the resource curse, the impacts of having a natural resources-based economy.
They're cleaning that up part of the agreement of them leaving?
Yes, though Suriname really has no environmental law, no comprehensive environmental law at all. There are bits and pieces of environmental regulations spread through the Surinamese code, but there's no EPA in Suriname or anything like that. And there was an agreement that Alcoa would clean up to U.S. standards, as they called it, and also Pennsylvania standards because of Alcoa's presence here. The question now is, you know, what are U.S. standards, particularly in the current environment? U.S. standards appear to be a little bit in flux. So that could end up being litigated if the Surinamese government does not believe that Alcoa lives up to this pledge. The estimate of the costs of cleaning up range from $225 million up into the $300 million range. And the person assigned to negotiate this deal by the Surinamese government has said, oh, it could cost $500 million and Alcoa would still pay. Alcoa hasn't signed on to that statement, but there's a big job to do there.
Alcoa is really trying to set itself apart as a global leader in sustainability. Is there history in Suriname and how they're leaving the country at odds with that?
Well, I guess it depends on which yardstick you look at. In 2015, in one of its sustainability reports, Alcoa said that it wanted to leave net positive impacts on biodiversity in the areas in which it operates. And there's an organization called Conservation International Suriname, which is a branch of the larger Conservation International, which is global. That Conservation International Suriname said, hey guys, when you're pulling out of Suriname, how about doing that standard, the one you espoused in 2015, in which you have a net positive impact on biodiversity? When we ran that by Alcoa after our process in Suriname, they said, well, that is an aspirational goal, not a guarantee. And we never really defined what net positive impact on biodiversity is. So that sounds like a really noble goal, net positive impact. That means if you came in and you altered a landscape, the landscape after you're done is even more diverse than the one you started with. It seems like it would be challenging to do that in a place like Suriname, which is, in its untouched areas, a Garden of Eden practically. And at this point, to us, Alcoa has not guaranteed that they will live up to that particular goal.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
No, my pleasure, Kara. Thank you.
Rich Lord is the projects reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. For the series, The Land Alcoa Dammed, he shares a byline with reporter Len Boselovic. Photography was by Stephanie Strasberg, and the series was in partnership with the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. There's a link to their work at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holzapfel. This next story is about rare wildflowers and a new species of orchid that was discovered in West Virginia a few years ago. Two orchid enthusiasts found a previously undiscovered species known as Shriver's Purple Frilly Orchid. Producer Roxy Todd traveled with them along the Highland Scenic Highway in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, to have a look at one of the mountain state's little-known botanical treasures.
I was sworn to secrecy not to reveal the location of our hike before they agreed to take me to see one of the rare orchids. After all, poachers have been known to dig them up. Let's just say we took a little walk along a road to a steep hillside in the misty mountains of Pocahontas County.
We are in a grassy area between the side of the road and the boreal forest that is common to the highlands of West Virginia.
This is Scott Shriver, a retired high school biology teacher from Pittsburgh, who helped discover the purple frilly orchid and named it after his dad.
He was my dad, and I think he was probably my best friend for 30 years. I really, you know, wanted to honor him, and so I asked if we could name it after him. He died in 2008. We published in 2008, and so it was a kind of a tribute to him.
A report about the new species was published in the North American Native Orchid Journal. But aside from a few orchid fans and scientists, few people heard about the discovery.
You know, as a school teacher, I would tell the kids that I actually participated in the naming of a new species. And so a lot of the kids would say, well, how much money did you get for that? Or, you know, how famous are you? And I'm like, no, there's no money. There's no fame.
The ground is spongy and mossy under our feet as we make our way down a hillside covered in green ferns and tall grass. Scott and his friend Cleet Smith, who helped discover the purple frilly, are on the hunt for the orchid they discovered. Then we spot them. Each of the plants have lots of little purple flowers, each shaped like an orchid, with a kind of a funny hat on top and a frilly ornamental skirt at its base.
The group of flowers on that stalk is called a raceme. And sometimes they'll have 40 or 50 flowers crowded very closely together. So each individual flower is no bigger than, say, maybe a nickel or maybe a quarter in some of the bigger ones. But if you get 100 of those all together on one raceme, it makes a pretty impressive display. So a lot of people would be excited to see that, and hopefully they wouldn't pick it, but it would be something that would be attractive to people who are pickers or what have you.
And then they see something they didn't expect to find.
Here's a Lassera.
I'll be darned. Where? I don't see it.
There it is.
They find a related species, a green orchid, right next to a very rare hybrid version. Basically, they think the green orchid crossed with the purple frilly they discovered to make a sort of orchid love child that has this cool green and purple color combination.
We found the other parent. So when this orchid, this green one, crosses with one of the purple shrivers, boom, that's what you get. And that's, it's a hybrid.
For these two orchid fans, this is like Christmas in July.
It's a treasure hunt. There's no doubt. It's treasure.
Scott and Cleet are part of an informal group of orchid hobbyists who scour the country looking for these wildflowers.
We just fell in love with orchids and we hunted them. I mean, we hunted them from Alaska to Newfoundland. I mean, North American orchids were our hobby. Some people play golf. We did North American orchids. So we were just orchid crazy.
West Virginia has a really good climate and geography for orchids, making it a secret hotbed for finding a lot of different types of flowers. So Cleet and Scott began making regular trips to visit. They even made a goal to see an orchid in every county in the state, and they did.
I mean, I know there's been a lot of cutting of forests, there's been coal mining, there's been a lot of damage that has occurred here, but there's a lot of little nooks and crannies that still exist here that are fairly pristine.
They found that many of the best places to see orchids are in the Monongahela National Forest, 300,000 acres of which are located in Pocahontas County.
And so we were drawn to Pocahontas County because it was like the pinnacle of orchids. You could see 18 or 20 species in one day in bloom.
Orchids even grow in places where you might not think to see them.
And some of the orchids love those pristine niches. Other orchids
love disturbed areas.
Like disturbed areas, like old strip mines is one of our favorite places to go orchiding. Not a strip mine that ended 2 years ago, but one that ended 30 years ago and is recovering by succession. Orchids are going to move into those areas. So West Virginia is just a great place. Pennsylvania's good. West Virginia's probably better. And so we spend a lot of time here.
Neither Scott nor Cleet are professional botanists, but they insist that anyone with an interest in exploring the outdoors can make big discoveries, especially in remote Appalachia.
I think there's stuff in the nooks and crannies of West Virginia that no one's ever seen or described before, and that's exciting. When you're here, it's kind of like you've escaped urban and suburban areas, and in a lot of places in West Virginia, it's wild.
But this abundantly diverse wildness is fragile. Deer are a threat to orchids, and there are poachers who steal them to grow in greenhouses or to plant in their backyards. Recently, an endangered orchid that grows on Sheep Mountain was nearly wiped out by poachers. So I assure Cleet and Scott, their secret is safe with me. If you want to find an orchid, you'll have to go driving out to the mountains yourself. Keep your eyes peeled, though, because you never know what you'll find on the back roads of West Virginia. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Roxy Todd in Pocahontas County, West Virginia.
Thanks to West Virginia Public Broadcasting and their podcast Inside Appalachia for that story. You can find more from their series about hidden gems in the mountains of Appalachia on their website, wvpublic.org. And thanks for listening to this week's Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. And special thanks to Paige Walter, our summer intern, who's on to bigger and better things. From all of us at the Allegheny Front, thanks, Paige. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation.